Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups of the Federalist Society. Today, we're honored to host the annual Mike Lewis Memorial Forum. Our moderator today is Professor Jeremy Rabkin. He is Professor Emeritus at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University. Prior to joining the faculty, he was for over two decades a professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University. He's also a longtime member of the International and National Security Law Practice Group at the Federalist Society. If you'd like to learn more about today's speaker and moderator, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our speaker gives his presentation, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Thank you. So I want to start just by saying a few words about Mike Lewis, in whose honor we're convened today. The Federalist Society, even the active membership, has people with very distinguished resumes, Supreme Court clerks, people who served at the Office of Legal Counsel and the Justice Department, various other positions that impressed people. Mike Lewis, in a way, outranked everyone because he was a Navy fighter pilot. He flew F-14s in the first Gulf War, which might make you think he was sort of like Tom Cruise. He was not. He was very calm. I would say he was, having known him over the years, he was rather self-confident. But he was a serious scholar, and I never heard him make reference to, well, when I was shooting down enemy planes, so this is how he went to the Harvard Law School after his service in the Navy. He was briefly in private practice, and then he taught at Ohio Northern University, where he taught torts and 1L subjects along with national security law topics. He published quite a number of articles in that field, and a number of them were cited by courts of appeals as just helpful authority. He died at the age of 50 from cancer. This was a loss not just to his immediate family, but to the FedSoc family, to national security law scholarship, and I would say, really, to our country. He was just hitting his stride. He would have become, I'm quite sure, an even more influential and important scholar in the field. So we are honoring him, but it is also, in a way, an honor to FedSoc to be able to host in his name. I think that Mike Newton will want to say a little more about him, but let me introduce Professor Newton first. Fitting speaker in this series because he also has a military background. He was a graduate of West Point, served in armor unit. Then he went to UVA Law School and the JAG School next door. He was in command of Army Special Forces Operational Law Unit in Operation Desert Storm. That's the same Gulf War. He helped to negotiate the elements of crimes for the International Criminal Court, and he's appeared several times before the International Criminal Court as a defense attorney. He was also very actively involved in advising Iraqi judges, both on the trial of Saddam Hussein after the following Gulf War, but also the trial of ISIS war criminals. He has been teaching at Vanderbilt for quite a few years, where he has his own program. And I should say, like Mike Lewis, he's been for many years active in this practice group. He has also this in common with Mike Lewis, and it's worth saying, a very gentlemanly demeanor. And it seems to me this is not only something that the military tries to inculcate to get the respect of the people that you're commanding, but also it suggests you know what you're doing, so you don't have to engage in bluster or bravado. And I don't think I've ever heard Mike Newton raise his voice. He has the confidence that he has reason behind him, and if that fails, there's a lot of force in the background. I will turn this over to him. Let me just say, he's going to speak for about 25 minutes, and then we'll take questions from Q&A scroll. But Mike, you wanted to start by saying a few things about Mike Lewis, who you also know.
I will, although I'm totally tempted to stop while I'm ahead. Better to be thought a fool than to open your mouth and prove the point. But I do want to say a couple of things about Mike Lewis. We had a very famous Vanderbilt law professor, Jonathan Charney, who many people know, negotiated the Law of the Sea Convention in a variety of ways, served in DOJ, et cetera, passed away in 2002. So just yesterday, we did our Charney lecture here at the law school on the subject of hostage diplomacy. And as a result, I polled Jonathan, Professor Charney was also the editor-in-chief of the American Journal of International Law. So in doing that, I polled the age-old tribute to Professor Charney, and it was almost serendipitous because I want to extract of words that were said about Professor Charney that just as easily could have been applied to Mike Lewis. And for those who don't know him, I would simply say, look at the pictures online and judge for yourself. You'll see kindness emanating. You'll see the kind of law professor who you would seek out for advice and who would give his time and to mentor, et cetera. That's the kind of guy that we honor. Jeremy and I are both busy people. But when they call and they say, do this thing to honor Mike Lewis, yes, we do. So there's three quotes from the age-old reference to Professor John Charney, which equally would have applied to Mike Lewis. Number one, he was a splendid scholar and a great and good man. Yes, I think that's absolutely correct. Many others I'll skip over, but his personal integrity and decency and loyalty were noteworthy. Yes, in dealing with him as a person. But the last is kind and generous thoughts and about just a delightful companion, as Jeremy has pointed out, a wonderful person to be at a conference with or to have a side discussion or a cup of coffee. The one that struck out to me, of course, because Professor Charney died of cancer in the same way as Mike, was his courage. And this is what they said, his courage. As we worked together over the period of his illness, there was no lessening in his careful attention to our shared responsibilities. You could have equally said that and powerfully about Mike Lewis. So that's the kind of character and the kind of personality that we honor. So my clock starts. I'm watching myself.
Actually, let me just add one thing. If you want to see a tribute from a former student, the Ohio Northern University Law Review for 2016 had a very nice article about Mike Lewis by his former student, Robert Luther, who's now at Scalia. And it was quite well done and brings out a number of features of his character. So, good.
I totally agree, and I wish I had thought to say that. As always, Jeremy self-corrects me. Thank you, Jeremy. So let me give you the bottom line up front in sort of classic fashion, Mike Newton fashion. This is where we're going to go, and I welcome questions on this. Really, two points. To quote Robert Jackson in the context of the post-Nuremberg era when he was discussing Nuremberg, he said, Robert Jackson said, that the Nazis, and here I'll say the Russians, have pursued their war of aggression with Machiavellian shamelessness. When we go down the long litany of war crimes and law of war violations, we could spend 10 hours, we could spend a week documenting. As you know, we've been supporting, of course, Ukrainian groups on the ground and some of the international efforts. And as is my professional habit, I've been assisting with Ukrainian judges in documenting and thinking through how to do these difficult cases. And I'll segue in a minute and describe what I mean by this, what I call the Russian way of war. But don't forget that what we're going to talk about today is only a subspecies of the dramatic war crimes that have been committed, as Robert would have said, Justice Jackson, with Machiavellian shamelessness, mistreatment of prisoners of war, egregious violations of the law of occupation with respect to occupied areas, as the International Criminal Court has pointed out, abduction of Ukrainian children, arguably genocide in that context against that backdrop, although the International Criminal Court didn't charge genocide in those cases. Shameless deliberately targeting civilian infrastructure and civilians, deliberate murder of civilians, just an incredible array of war crimes, which leads me to my second introductory point. In my business of international criminal law, after the recent experiences in Iraq and watching in real time some of the failures in Syria to date and some of the failures in Ukraine with respect to accountability, it's my personal position that the field of international criminal law is in something of an existential crisis. I watched over the last 5 years, and I assisted with judges. We've watched the United Nations simply abandon Yazidi victims. The international community as a whole has been ineffectual and has completely turned its back on Yazidi victims and on Iraqi judges trying to do the right thing. That's a separate story. My tagline for this discussion is that I believe we're on the cusp of the exact same existential crisis in the field of the law of war and internet, what we in the larger sense call international humanitarian law. We've watched egregious violations in a series of conflicts: Syria, the Chechen War, Georgia, just to name a few, Azerbaijan, Armenia. Horrific violations. Ethiopia, Eritrea, horrific violations. The violations in Ukraine have been of a scale and an intensity and a sustained magnitude that if we only do a couple of cases here and there, or as they have done, the Ukrainian judges keep chopping away, trying to prosecute people as they have done with no publicity, with very little assistance, despite the rhetoric and despite the millions of dollars of, you know, it's essentially a jobs program to try to help them. But on the ground, almost no assistance. And yet intense criticism for their very efforts. If we don't unite to recognize, to address these particular crimes, then I believe we really are at an existential crisis with respect to the laws of war writ large. And I'm happy to give more details and more examples. So let me spend a few minutes describing the Russian way of war as I see it. And then I want to drill down and give you what I think are very graphic, very concrete examples of, at least in particular, one case that I believe we have a duty to prosecute. And I don't say that lightly, to foreshadow where we're going to go. Just as when a terrorist murders an American citizen overseas, we should hunt that terrorist to the ends of the earth and prosecute them and bring them to justice if we are able to, when we have the evidence, when we can get them. No terrorist in the world should target an American in the same way that no country in the world should kidnap an American just because they're an American and try to engage in hostage diplomacy to wring asymmetric diplomatic concessions from the United States. I say the same about war crimes. We're going to talk about the case of Pete Reed, who was an American medic, former Marine. There's no such thing as a former Marine. A Marine who had served in Afghanistan was killed on February 2nd, 2023, working as a medic for an NGO called Global Response Medicine. And I'll describe some of the facts and the evidence of that case. I believe our Justice Department has a duty to prosecute the Russian perpetrators. But that's only emblematic of what I mean by this larger Russian way of war. So let me explain that. What the Russians have done in the midst of all these other massive quantitative violations of the laws of war is develop their own you could almost say special, the Russian way of war, it, with a hostility and a ferocity. The basic gist of it is that they've leveraged humanitarian suffering and war crimes as an asymmetric tool of warfare. So what that means is, and let me hesitate for just a second. I think everybody watching realizes, otherwise you wouldn't be watching, that humanitarian interests are the load-bearing pillar. The entire body of law of war collapses if we simply ignore humanitarian interests. I mean, the entire field began with the suffering of innocent civilians and the suffering of combatants, right? So the duty of all parties to provide medical assistance to all parties on the basis of ethics and integrity and essentially a triage of who needs the greatest treatment the fastest and what supplies do we have, who can we help. That's basic medical ethics, but it's also the sine qua non of the law of war. If we take that out of the law of war, the entire foundation crumbles. And yet, that's been the Russian way of war. So this is an integrated diplomatic strategy. It's an integrated military strategy designed to use human suffering among both the military and the civilian population in a way that leverages the deprivation of medical assistance to essentially cut the legs out of the Ukrainian war effort. Imagine, just for a second, if you're a Marine lying on the ground in Fallujah and you scream, "Medic, come help me." And your medical support people, whether they're Iraqi or American or allied, hesitate to come and help you because they're afraid of unlawfully being targeted. That's exactly what the Russians have been doing. But it's even worse in the Russian context in Ukraine, because what they've done is try to create this escalating series of much broader effects, not just on the battlefield, but across the whole society. So as a result, you've seen them interdicting bombing ICRC vehicles that are carrying food and medicine. So the intentional exacerbation of humanitarian suffering, not just to affect combatant activities at a tactical level, but to create this broader, more insidious effect on, you could say, the larger Ukrainian civilization, larger Ukrainian society. And as we know, of course, it's obvious, but I'm a law professor, so I have to state the obvious, right? Medical personnel and medical facilities and medical worker are entitled to sanctified protection in the law of war. That's just, without that, you have no law of war. And as an extension, the infrastructure that supports them is also entitled to affirmative protection, no qualifications, no caveats, no hesitation, no limitations. So what they've done is develop this intentional pattern of deliberately attacking medical personnel, medical facilities. You know, the most egregious in the early days was the bombing of the Children's Hospital in Mariupol. But by my records, as of November 2024, over 1,500 deliberate attacks against medical personnel and medical facilities. And among those, over 230 medical personnel who are absolutely entitled to protected person status in the law of war have been, and I use this word deliberately, murdered by the Russians. That's the Russian way of war, to attack civilian infrastructure in ways that deprive the population of humanitarian assistance, to attack maternity hospitals, to attack orphanages in ways that create this sense of hopelessness among the civilian population. Those are all law of war violations. But for my purposes, when you turn to murdering Americans, you wake up the American juridical tiger. We need to go after these perpetrators in a way that they know you cannot intentionally murder Americans on the battlefield. So let me give you a little bit of the background in terms of where this came from, in terms of this deliberate tactic of the Russian way of war. And then I want to give you the facts of the Pete Reed case, which I think is the most emblematic case for American interests. But I could give you 150 other examples, or, you know, we could go down the other 234 examples of people, medical personnel, intentionally murdered by the Russians. And oh, by the way, in case you missed it, not more than 10 days ago, the Russians struck the center of Dobropetrovka in the Donetsk province. And they did what they typically do. The rule of thumb is you wait about 35 to 40 minutes, and then you do what in military terms we would call a double tap, a double strike. In other words, wait just long enough. They've done this in mall attacks. They've done it repeatedly in urban attacks. When you attack an apartment building and the medical relief workers flood in, you give them about 40 minutes to get there, to unpack, to start pulling people out, to start triaging, to start rendering medical care. And then you launch an intensive salvo. And these are precision-guided munitions. This is not accidental. That kills both any civilians left alive, but also the medical workers and the medical vehicles. And the, and they wait. Typically, the rule is 35 to 40 minutes. Not 10 days ago, they did this in the Donetsk province. President Zelensky called it a vile and inhumane intimidation tactic. And he's right. That's the Russian way of war. Writ large. And I could give you many other examples from Ukraine. December of 22, we had counted at that point about 707 attacks. So since December of 22, and the point of that is they front-loaded attacks. The proportion of attacks in a proportionate way was front-loaded. And oh, by the way, it's worth pointing out that this is all self-defeating because every medical personnel that they harm and every vehicle that they harm has an ethical and professional and legal duty to facilitate relief to all sides equally. You've seen, if you're paying attention to this, many examples of Ukrainian medical personnel providing relief to Russian prisoners of war or North Korean prisoners of war, giving them food, medicine, treatment that they wouldn't have gotten even in Russian captivity or Russian custody. In many cases, far better than they would have gotten. But there's this long pattern of these attacks. July 22-24 near Kharkiv. July 8, they attacked a children's hospital and did the same thing. August 2023, Pokrovsk. Many, many, many examples of this pattern of activity with generally the same pattern. You do an initial attack. You wait about 35 to 40 minutes. And then you do this double strike. So why do I call this the Russian way of war? You can go back very easily and get documented examples of this in the first Chechen War. And if you're careful about it and you're paying attention to the tactical lessons, what you actually see are evolutions in Russian tactics. Oh, we didn't wait long enough. We didn't kill enough medics, so we're going to wait a little longer. Or, well, you know, we did the double tap strike. We killed a few, but we need to do a much more intensive strike. So commonly what you'll see as now the evolved practice of the Russians is a much more sustained and intensive strike even after the first strike. And the point is, we want to make sure we kill as many innocent civilians, as many wounded and sick as we can. But oh, by the way, if an ambulance survives that melee, we take it as a tactical defeat. So that was the tactics begun in the first Chechen War. We saw it in Syria, particularly in Idlib. You can see some documentaries out there about the White Helmets who are emblematic of that. But, you know, let's be clear that the civilian workers running out under fire to provide medical care at all times, in all weather, to all people, is to me one of the cardinal tenets of the law of war. And I'll restate what I said up front. I believe that the entire field of the law of war, unless we confront the Russian way of war directly, we call it what it is, we prosecute it, I think we're letting termites into the entire structure of the law of war that will destroy the entire field over time. Because this is so egregious, so intentional, so emblematic. You know, in Idlib, you saw intentional attacks. One example of a pattern of attacks documented by the New York Times was attacks on four hospitals in the space of about 12 hours with the typical accompanying double tap strikes, larger fields, larger dispersions. And, you know, they're smart. If you attack vehicles while they're inbound, you're only getting one at a time or a small group of medical people. Why not wait a little longer? Wait till they're all centralized. Wait till they're busy doing their jobs. Wait till they're actually not paying attention to the air raid sirens and the incoming artillery fire and precision guided munitions. Why? Because they're doing their job, providing humanitarian relief to everybody that they come across who needs it. And that's what we mean by the Russian way of war. It demoralizes military forces, but it deprives both civilian and military of the larger infrastructure, whether it's ambulances, something as simple as ambulances, medical supplies, which are already scarce on a battlefield, O positive blood. I'm O positive, so I kind of want all the O positive blood out there to be preserved, because when I need O positive blood, I need it. Don't give me A positive, I need O positive. Those kinds of things have a much larger effect on both the military and the society, because they exacerbate human suffering in a way that is, I hate to use the word because it sounds trite, but it's horrifying. That's the Russian way of war. That's what Robert Jackson was talking about, Machiavellian shamelessness. So let me just give you the example of Pete Reed, and then I'll give you, let me backtrack for just a second. The risky strategy, which if we're bold, I think we would go down, would be to adopt one feature of the Iraqi tribunal system that has gotten very little, almost no commentary in the wider world, in part because people don't read the Arabic opinions, in part because of the image that they were somehow unfair, which you know, we can debate that. But in the detailed opinion, the Iraqi judges did something incredibly important. I can send you the satellite imagery if you want to email me, or you can buy my book. I put this picture in the book. But when Saddam was angry at that particular Iraqi town, in order to punish the entire town, what he did was he destroyed their agricultural areas, these beautiful centuries-old date palm orchards. It's almost like the Carthaginians, where, you know, the Romans salted the land with salt and destroyed Carthaginian agriculture. That's what Saddam did to that town. And so obviously, you know, the war crime, that's easy. But what the Iraqis did was a little more adventurous and creative, but if you read the opinion, actually very well justified. They prosecuted that, in addition to the war crimes charges, as the crime against humanity of inhumane acts. Meaning, I'm deliberately inflicting conditions of life, to use the genocide language, that are inhumane, that cause larger suffering just beyond the narrow thing I'm doing, a larger, much larger pattern of inhumanity. That, to me, is the Russian way of war. So I do think it's conceptually possible to prosecute these crimes as the crime against humanity of either persecution or inhumane acts. I think inhumane acts is probably preferable. That's bold and risky. But at a minimum, these are grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions. That's unequivocally true. And because they're grave breaches, and because you're intentionally attacking civilians, because you fail to comply with the proportionality principle, there is zero military necessity for attacking humanitarian relief columns, humanitarian supplies, and humanitarian workers. Zero. Which makes every one of these things, by definition, a disproportionate strike. Separate topic. But they're also grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions, which is important because it means that every NATO ally, every European country, every country of the world has an affirmative duty to prosecute Russians. In our case, I'll give you the example of Pete Reed. As I mentioned, the American Marine in Ukraine, working for the NGO Global Response Medicine, strike happens. They go, and there are examples, by the way, real life examples of the Russians, you know, men on crutches that they're targeting and beaten to death. Those kinds of things, just horrific. Thousands of those. But in the case of Pete Reed, it's a classic double strike. You know, there's a military strike. They show up, this NGO who's there just doing good things, helping people. They knew of these patterns of double strike. And that's what I want to emphasize. That's why I think American officials have a duty to prosecute these perpetrators. They knew that this was a pattern. And what they do, they drove anyway, because it's their ethical duty. That's what they do. That's who they were as men and professionals. So they drive up, and I'll read you the eyewitness testimony from an Estonian volunteer that we've interviewed, who actually filmed. So this actual double strike attack, it's not theoretical, even though it's happened thousands of times across Iraq and Syria. This is not theory. This is the eyewitness account. Here's what he says. We captured the blast with our phone, and he told CNN he was seated in the frontline medic's vehicle. He was in the vehicle when the missiles began to hit. He was filming the team through the car window. And he was afraid, this Estonian medic, that his vehicle would be targeted next. So he jumped out of the vehicle. He took shelter in the ditch, but his phone kept running, recording the missile strikes. And this is incredible testimony. This is trial-ready evidence. I mean, I'm a former prosecutor. I'm ready to take that case because I've got the live eyewitness who can corroborate the videotape. It's not some AI doctored thing on YouTube, or this is not fantasy. This is not propaganda. And let me say in passing, one of the things that the Russians have repeatedly done to exacerbate the Russian way of war is that when these issues come up, the Russian claim is that's just propaganda. That's just Western misinformation. That's just disinformation to try to exacerbate the fog of war. Not true. That's intentionally using the media and social media in particular to cloud the facts. So this Estonian medic jumped behind a tree, waited for the smoke to clear. Every bit of this is on tape. We also have two surviving witnesses of the double tap murder, both Norwegian, who were right alongside Pete Reed. They were lucky enough to make it out. And so you can geolocate. We know exactly where this happened. We know exactly how it happened. We know it's emblematic of the broader way of war. And I would urge our Justice Department and the FBI to get focused, to prosecute this case, because in a way, it's representative of thousands of other victims. And to be clear, because these are grave breaches, every country in the world has affirmative basis of jurisdiction when that perpetrator is on their territory. And some, of course, have statutes that will allow other bases of jurisdiction. But in our case, when you're murdering an American medic who's simply doing his job out there, what you're doing is allowing the Russians to leverage humanitarian suffering as an affirmative, asymmetric, and the key word is illegal way of war. This is cold-blooded murder in a way that violates every tenet of the law of war. And I'll end where I began by saying, in the same way as when terrorists intentionally kidnap Americans because of their nationality, we should do everything to find them, to free them, to release them. In the same way, when foreign governments intentionally capture Americans to try to get a diplomatic edge, in the language of the terrorist bombing convention, to try to force the U.S. government to do or to abstain from doing some other act, I call this hostage diplomacy, we should not stand for that. We should address it forthrightly and try to change the international dynamic. When you murder American medics, P. Reed in this case, emblematic of hundreds and hundreds of others from all nations of the world, that's the quintessential international legal concept of what we call erga omnes obligations, right? Every country in the world, every military practitioner in the world shares a common interest in preserving the ability of medical personnel on the battlefield of any nationality to provide medical care to anybody who needs it, of any party, civilian or military, simply on the basis of triage. And of course, Mike Lewis spent most of his career talking about targeting issues. He would have been incensed. He would have been outraged by this, as am I. And I think to the extent that the United States of America pretends to stand for the law of war and pretends to have an influence in shaping the norms and customs of warfare, which we do, we owe it to the world to prosecute these perpetrators. We need to find them. We need to identify them. We need to prosecute them. And the message is clear that we would have done the same regardless of nationality, because this is a shared norm. And if you take away the right to receive medical treatment on the battlefield, in any context, no matter who you are, no matter what the wounds you're suffering, then as I say, we have gutted the entire body of the law of war. This is a foundational premise. And I'll end with a simple exhortation. The Russian way of war, not to sound like Gandalf, but this shall not pass. That is beyond the pale. No civilized country, no civilized military can look at that and say, well, there are exceptions. There are gray areas. There are no gray areas here. And we need to find these people and prosecute them, and by extension, facilitate our allies in prosecuting their victims. And with that, I have used up my time almost exactly on the spot.
Oop, Jeremy, I think you're muted.
Thank you. Let me pose you two questions and we can get to some of the other questions that are being posed in the Q&A. So the first one is, it's shocking, it's horrifying, and it's demoralizing that the Russians let themselves pursue these tactics. Which makes you think, they will stop at nothing. But actually, they have stopped short of doing things that, if I could call them their predecessors, President Assad in Syria used chemical weapons. President Saddam Hussein seems to have used biological weapons. There are certain lines the Russians have not crossed. And I wonder if you have an explanation of why they let themselves go in some areas, but seem to respect international law in other areas. And is that at all encouraging for the project of making international standards that some of them, even the Russians, have respected?
That's a good point. I mean, I think in the Russian case, to be blunt about it and to be undiplomatic at the present time, I'm not a diplomat. What the Russians respect is actual deterrence and actual consequences. That's true in hostage diplomacy. It's true in the case of biological weapons. It's true in the case of chemical weapons. You know, it's controversial in some circles. But when President Biden says, if you use chemical weapons in Syria, it's a red line. They use chemical weapons, they get away with it. And then they watch the Syrians use chemical weapons, and they watch the Trump administration the first time around respond immediately and forcefully. And, you know, academics around the world and the chattering heads argue about the circumstances of that. But you notice no more use of chemical weapons in the Syrians. And I think that the deterrence message in the case of both of those methods of war were sent very clearly, which feeds my larger point. To the extent that we allow Russians to murder medical personnel and do nothing about it, very little protest in the international community. We're simply facilitating and encouraging, the psychological term is enabling. And I think we do that at both our danger and at risk to every functional military in the world. As I say, this is one of the core tenets of the law of armed conflict. To the extent that we care about the field at all, and we care about military discipline and professionalism, this is a tactic that we can't let them get away with. And I think it's important to say again, not to be a law professor, but to reiterate what I said earlier, there is no gray area. You know, we can argue about proportionality in some strikes and attacks on the electric grid, and there's a lot of law of war issues raised in Ukraine. This one, no gray area whatsoever. We need to find them. We need to call it out for what it is. We need to prosecute. We need to facilitate our allies prosecuting. And in order to say to them, that's a bridge too far. You went too far.
So in one sentence, your answer is chemical and biological weapons they see as there's a bright red line there. This line has not seemed bright enough to them.
Correct.
Yeah, okay. So second question, and then we can go to accumulating questions on the board here. Before the Second World War, it was the usual practice when you made a peace treaty, you included in the peace treaty waiver of all legal claims, including claims about war crimes that arose during the war, because you wanted the peace treaty to establish peace, and you didn't want loose ends that would be irritants and provocations to renewal of conflict. Suppose President Putin says, okay, I'm willing to agree to peace, but everyone has to drop all their claims against Russia. Would you advise the Trump administration better to continue the war than have that kind of peace agreement, or should we agree to it and then just not adhere to it? How do you resolve that trade-off?
Well, it's a very difficult trade-off. I mean, you go back to, I think of Ambassador Holbrooke negotiating the Dayton Accords, trying to end the Bosnia War. Karadzic went to his grave arguing that Ambassador Holbrooke promised him immunity.
Yes.
Those are all of his petitions to the Yugoslavia War Crimes Tribunal. Yeah. I'm glad you asked that. I deliberately didn't go there because I could talk about it for 2 hours.
Talk about it for like 5 minutes.
I will, or less. Two issues. Number one, these offenses are non-biodegradable in the sense that they don't go away. And I think we do have an affirmative duty, no matter what happens with actual prosecutions, to create the historical record and to share these lessons and this tactic, the Russian way of war, with friends and allies around the world. And in so doing, the first level to me is deterrence and punishment. So prosecution is different. It's a tertiary issue. The core thing for me is preserving the integrity of the law of war. And to the extent that we say, oh, nothing to see here, just move along, we're contributing to the degradation of the law of war. It's hypocritical on our part to simply say that and say, nothing to worry about. You bomb a children's hospital in Mariupol, no problem. So I don't think we can do that in terms of the historical record and the integrity of the law. With respect to prosecutions, there's really two elements here. Article 53 of the Rome Statute says that the court can dismiss cases in the interest of justice. So one, the ICC approach to date, which has not taken action on these issues, but I think might, to be clear, I think these are issues that would be very ripe and appealing to the ICC prosecutor Karim Khan, because they have this tendency to go after symbolic cases, right? Think about Timbuktu and Mali. The victim said, you know, we asked for justice. You give us a trial of dust and stones, right? This is a highly symbolic case. I could absolutely see the ICC being interested. So one approach would not to build an amnesty into an agreement with respect to the ICC, but a continuing series of Article 16 deferrals through the Security Council, which the Russians would absolutely agree to. So in other words, you stay the power of the ICC.
And they would veto every initiative, yes.
Exactly. So absent that, the ICC charges will not go away. That's the point. It's non-biodegradable in the International Criminal Court. And we can debate that, but that comes from the own ICC policy. In the ICC context, I'm reminded of the day in trial when Saddam Hussein is ranting and raging and trying to feed the insurgency. And the judge looks down at him and says, this is a trial like any other, governed by rules and law and procedure. You're a defendant like any other, governed by rules and procedure. If you want to make a legal point, make it. Otherwise, sit down or I will have you removed from court. And the ICC would take the same approach. We don't do politics. We don't do amnesties. We don't do forgiveness. We do trials based on procedure.
That's much easier to do when the tyrant has been removed from power.
Correct. But just ask the Philippine Duterte how long that lasts, or ask Laurent Gbagbo how long that lasts.
I mean, these are changing circumstances. I don't believe Putin will voluntarily retire.
No, he won't. But you may have a change of scenery and a change of administrations. You know, if I were an incoming Russian administration and I wanted sanctions relief, that's an easy trade to make.
Maybe.
Particularly, and this is one of the things that bothers me about a current ICC practice, you've seen a pattern of taking political opposition and simply sending them to the court as a way of removing political opposition. So if I'm a new powerful feature of Russian society, that's an easy choice to make. Because I wouldn't have gone anyway. I'm happy to let them deal with it, all of that. But I think the bigger point to make is that there can be no amnesty in a peace deal Remember the parties. They cannot commit, for example, German prosecutors or American prosecutors or Dutch prosecutors unless you have a comprehensive global deal. These are grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions that can, in my view, should be prosecuted all around the world. And I think that's a different treaty. That's a different set of negotiations than a narrow treaty between the Russians and the Ukrainians.
So we've had several questions come onto the screen, which people say, isn't the relevant criterion here whether a particular military action is necessary? And if it helps the Russians win, maybe in their mind, it's necessary. Or are you saying, no, you have to be prepared to limit your tactics, even if it makes your victory harder to achieve, because international law is more important than winning and losing, which is easy to say to the Russians, maybe not so easy to say to the Ukrainians.
Right. Oh, that's a wonderful question. I'm going to take it and slightly torque it.
I already torqued it a little from what people posted, but that's okay. The gist of what they were asking.
But I mean, the essence of the question, for those who really aren't aware of the backdrop, is how does the law of armed conflict balance, as Jeremy just said, you know, the desire to win and the need to win a war? We win the war by killing as many people as possible, as quickly as possible, with the greatest extent possible. But by the same token, the law of armed conflict absolutely has this ineffable, would be the law professor word, but beautiful strand of humanitarian interests and humanity. So the point is that the law of war already incorporates both of those strands in the appropriate balance. That's why, for example, there's this litany of rules that do restrict the way I can conduct conflict, right? I have to give civilian warnings in civilian areas when circumstances permit. The proportionality rule is a hard rule. It's a subjective set of evaluations, but it's an objective rule applying subjective criteria, right? I can never intentionally launch an attack in the knowledge that it'll cause damage to military lives or civilians, et cetera. That's clearly excessive in relation to the concrete and direct military advantage. We already do what you're describing, Jeremy. In the case of medics, humanitarian interests, humanitarian personnel, there is no latitude in the law of war whatsoever based on military necessity or military advantage anticipated when medics like Pete Reed are at a site rendering affirmative aid to all people, and you wait 35 to 40 minutes and do a double strike, it's a war crime. There's no military necessity even conceivable. And when you repeat that pattern, I mean, one of the failures here to me is also the International Committee of the Red Cross, who takes a passive view. They've attacked ICRC facilities, ICRC vehicles, with very little public protest. This is the kind of thing that the ICRC should be on the front lines to the entire world. And in a way, I think they've copped out because of their own institutional interests. This is the kind of thing where they should be leading the cry to document cases, to help prosecute, et cetera. And I know that that's contrary to ICRC policy, but that's the way I see it. So I'm the speaker. That's my personal opinion. But I think other governments should work together to do exactly the same thing, because there is never a legitimate military necessity for doing double tap strikes. And to the extent that we don't highlight that and prosecute it, we're actually facilitating repetition of that tactic across other conflicts.
So a number of people have raised the question, why do you call it the Russian way of war? Isn't this really a prevalent way of war among nasty regimes that have been involved in conflict over the last, well, let's say in this century, not to mention all the preceding centuries?
Right.
So why are we getting worked up about Russia when we pretty much shrugged off Syria, what China is doing to the Uyghurs, lots of other atrocities in the world? Maybe it looks like this is not about maintaining international standards, but about pursuing our ongoing adversarial relationship with Russia.
Yeah, and I was careful the way I phrased that. Remember where I started. This is not about the Russians or the Chinese or anybody else. To me, it's about the integrity of the laws of war. as a profession, Mike Lewis would have been jumping in his seat, cheering at that proposition, that we have an affirmative duty, whether it's the Russians or the Chinese, or let's be honest, Americans in Haditha who murder civilians. We have a duty to prosecute them equally. So this is about the integrity of the laws of war. And I often use the analogy, if there are 10 bank robbers, but I can only catch one or two, should I not prosecute those one or two because I can't prosecute the other eight for either non-justiciable or lack of evidence or lack of political will, or I can't get them extradited? No. When you can capture the bank robbers, you prosecute the ones you can capture in a way that's comporting with due process and proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Well, I call it the Russian way of war because they're the ones that have invented this technique and perfected it. And you watch the pattern. Maybe I need to write the book, The Russian Way of War, on this, right? It's not just a run-of-the-mill war crime or a run-of-the-mill mistreatment of the civilian population. This is an intentional, strategic, and tactical campaign to aggrandize human suffering that doesn't just affect combatants. It doesn't just affect the narrow medical people there. What they're trying to do is to have reverberating effects, to use the targeting concept, across all of Ukrainian society. And, you know, if you're in labor, but your pediatrician was killed the night before by the Russians, but you're 100 miles from the front lines, you got a problem. And that's what they're trying to do, is to destroy Ukrainian in the larger sense. That's why it's the Russian way of war, because you don't see other militaries using this particular tactic. They've perfected it. You know, they've tinkered with the area strikes, the weapons used, the timing, the angles of attack. You can actually track the evolution and the perfection of this tactical technique. And frankly, one of the upsetting things is that we haven't seen more public outcry over that. The Ukrainians have no choice. They've got to put their heads down and keep waging war. But the rest of the world should be outraged at this.
Okay, so change of topic, but I will come back to the main topic. So somebody asked, the Americans who have been the victims of these attacks, should they really be in Ukraine, since they are basically assisting a foreign military at a time when the United States is not actually declared war? What's the legal status of those people? And one step above American neutrality law or whatever we have now, is this totally consistent with international law that you can send your people to go and assist foreign armies? And you have no responsibility for anything that happens?
Well, the short answer is yes, at least from the American political perspective. But P. Reid is a classic example. I mean, we've seen humanitarian workers targeted in Gaza for delivering food and medicine. That's a war crime. And they're there in a private capacity representing an NGO, as P. Reid was. But many others who have, you know, enlisted in a proper way. They're combatants, fully developed combatants in the Ukrainian structure. And, you know, we live in a culture of personal freedom. That's totally legal. But in the case of NGOs, you know, Doctors Without Borders, Medicine Sans Frontières, Schoolhouses Without Borders, all these NGOs that do this, the World Food Kitchen in Gaza, lots of examples, totally lawful. And just because they're not uniformed combatants, or as we would say, protected persons in the military structure, they don't lose one ounce of protection under the laws and customs of war. They're equally protected. I would even go so far, and I'm considering a law review piece on this, called the humanitarian imperative. I think we have an affirmative duty to protect humanitarian interests, and the narrow, to be controversial, as if I haven't been already controversial enough. If I were at the NSC and I watched the Russians bombing a children's hospital in Mariupol, I would have simply said, I'm sending in a C-17 at this time, at this altitude, if so much as, and I'm taking out orphans and widows and the people on walkers who you're trying to murder. And if you so much as turn on a targeting radar, we will use defensive force. I think we should have called Putin's bluff on that. And I think we have the right to do that under international law, very narrowly construed and in a totally transparent way, in the same way as P. Reed. I think we have the right to prosecute his murderers. And I would go so far as to say the duty to prosecute his murderers, not from international law, but from our sovereign prerogatives.
So there are a number of questions asked. How well do we actually uphold these standards with the American military? Like, was World War II city bombing consistent with international law? And you don't have to get into that in particular, but there have been these episodes in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think President Trump's personal view is these are not things to pursue. He's pardoned people in some cases. Do you think we, on the whole, maintain an adequate level of, I guess enforcement is the right word, of these standards among our own military personnel?
I absolutely think we do. But remember, it's not static, right? These standards are shared by professional militaries of the world. This is one of the reasons why, even with Russian colleagues, I love the law of war. I can go, we can have the debate about the law. Feasible measures, the duty to warn, the duty to presume civilian status, the technical details of the law, because those things are shared by militaries around the world. The law changes. To use your World War II example, there's a specific provision in the additional protocol where we took World War II practice and we said, okay, we're going to constrain that in the following circumstances.
You say we, but we in the United States are not parties to it.
We help negotiate it in the same way that we joined consensus on the ICC elements of crimes.
We remember that the Senate has to ratify treaties and has not ratified this.
Totally agree. But what we're talking about, what I'm talking about, is the pattern of states of the way we govern good order and discipline on the battlefield, and I would say professionalism. Take a group of young Marines in Fallujah, of all walks of life, of all races, of all ethnicities, rich kids, poor kids, you know, stubborn kids, nice kids, and try to create a disciplined, cohesive fighting force. It's not just about tyrannical commanders. It's about a backbone of discipline and professionalism. That's what the law of war does. And to the extent that we allow it to be degraded or not punished, what we're actually doing is introducing indiscipline, unprofessionalism. And I believe we have a duty as a professional military to prosecute those cases. I'm concerned about some of our current structures for obvious reasons. But in the larger sense, Mike Lewis would have been the first cheerleader to say that professional militaries, with respect to targeting, have a non-derogable. There's no exceptions. We must uphold that body of law.
So I think we have time for one more question. Several people have posted comments saying what the Russians are doing is being done by other countries. The most recent one is that this is happening in Myanmar. Other people have given other examples. Would you say that we should focus particular attention on Russia because it's on the largest scale, or because they're the most powerful perpetrator, or the most prominent practitioner of these abuses, so it matters more if they get away with it? Or do you think, yes, we should go after Russians, but after the others as well? What's your...
Well, that's
a concluding statement about the significance of your comments on the Russian way of war.
Yeah, the macro question is, yes, there are human rights abuses. I'm involved, just full disclosure, in the Gambia, Myanmar case at the International Court of Justice, proving genocide against the Myanmar junta. So, you know, we have a variety of tools at our disposal to deal with human rights abuses or genocidal claims or crimes against humanity around the world. So, you know, there's nothing in that sense unique the questioner would ask, or the questioners, plural. That's right. War crimes, crimes against humanity, law of war violations happen in all conflicts. And we have varying tools to deal with all of those. I call it the Russian way of war because this specific tactic of intentionally attacking protected persons, protected facilities, and then doing the double strike, and then exacerbating that, of attacking, you know, even the relief convoys, the humanitarian supplies. The Russians have field tested that. And I'm frankly, I'd love to be educated. You know, I'm a learner. I have an experiment. If somebody finds other examples of that, educate me. I'd love to have it. But that's why I call it the Russian way of war. They invented this. They've perfected it over a series of conflicts. They've changed tactics, both in Chechnya and Syria. They've taught others to try to do that. So you see this with them teaching Mali, for example, with them trying to change the conduct of the Syrian regime, right? So that's the problem here, is that this is a unique Russian, if you will, patented invention. And I think one that, here's my concluding statement, one that does unique harm to civilized society, to the interests of humanity, and in this case, to American interests. Americans have a sovereign interest in protecting, preventing you from murdering American medics, period.
They are not only perpetrators, but proliferators of these crimes. Yes, I get that. Okay, thank you. This has been a very good discussion. And I think a fitting honor to Mike Lewis. Thank you.
Indeed. Thank you for your time.
Yes. Well, Jeremy and Mike, thank you guys so much. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you for the benefit of your time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.